Hello and welcome to Over the Edge. This episode features an interview between Bill Pfeiffer and Jackson Rep, the field CTO at HarperDB, a globally distributed edge application platform. Jackson has over 25 years of experience architecting, designing, and developing enterprise software. He's the founder of three technology startups and has consulted with multiple Fortune 500 companies on IoT and digital transformation initiatives. In this conversation, Bill and Jackson discuss the future of bespoke models and whether they'll be essential to business moving forward. They also dive into distributed data solutions and bringing the ease of the cloud to the edge. But before we get into it, here's a brief word from our sponsors.
Over the Edge is brought to you by Dell Technologies to unlock the potential of your infrastructure with edge solutions. From hardware and software to data and operations, across your entire multi-cloud environment, we're here to help you simplify your edge so that you can generate more value. Learn more by visiting dell.com/edge for more information or click on the link in the show notes.
And now, please enjoy this interview between Bill Pfeiffer and Jackson Rep, field CTO at HarperDB.
Jackson, thanks so much for joining us today. This is going to be a fun conversation. I know I've had enough coffee and you're a fun guy, and this is just going to be a rollicking good time. So I hope everyone's ready for a great episode, but I am looking forward to it.
I love the way you oversell things.
I used to be in marketing, so there
you go. What, you head of marketing over there?
So it's always great to start with a little bit of history and find out kind of how you got here, why we're having this conversation, right? Can you tell us how you got started in technology?
Sure. I was a copywriter, post-grad school, kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I sat down next to some people at a trivia night and they were all getting along and it became obvious they worked together. And I was like, what do you guys all do? Because I don't have a, you know, I don't go to an office. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we're in advertising. And I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll do that. Do you have computers and websites and stuff? Because I just taught myself how to build websites on AOL. And they're like, we do. We already have that guy, but we do need a copywriter. And I was like, okay. So I went to work. And the day that my copy was done and was supposed to be put on the customer site, that guy was out. And so I leveraged what little skill I had to FTP my copy up to the internet, which made the actual guy so upset that he quit, at which point I got his job and was woefully unqualified for that, and then moved through a few agencies. This was, you know, 1999, right before the dot-com crash. We were charging people $1 million for something you could build in WordPress in 15 minutes. We were the only ones who could do it at the time, right? It was a new frontier, and mm-hmm. It was a ton of fun. And I didn't really understand a lot other than basic HTML and very basic JavaScript. And then one day, the computer programming classes, you know, just the basic programming classes that my father had taken me to go to in seventh grade, all of a sudden everything clicked. I understood JavaScript. I understood HTML. I understood Fusion. I understood P and Tomcat. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, for whatever reason, my brain just kind of Neo in the Matrix and I got it. And from then mm-hmm. It became a pursuit of sort of optimizing that process and making it more efficient from a coding templates perspective to backend automation, you know, generating stuff from a JSON schema or from a document of another kind. So really I didn't have to work that hard. I wanted to make it easy. And I got reasonably good at that. And as I would rise up through different agencies or different development shops, what I learned about myself was unless I'm wearing many hats, unless I'm, you know, the architect and still have some role in kind of how that, you know, product is built behind it, mm-hmm. then I feel too disconnected from it. So after I left the agency, I went into the startup world, and this is my eighth startup. I tend to go into, you know, very early stage where it absolutely functions. It's super utilitarian, but it accomplishes the goal and hopefully it does whatever it's trying to do in a new and unique way. And I then come in with, again, my inherent laziness and desire to never have to write documentation to build, you know, this into a product that's so easy to use that nobody ever reads, nobody ever needs the docs mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. then I won't have to write them. Or if I do, that can be very minimal. So that has kind of been my focus for the last, I guess, 15 years, has been finding these systems that are about ready to, you know, go to market, about ready to, you know, differentiate themselves against their competitors, and figuring out how to make that look, make it look easy. And then I got a job with an IoT company, and we were working on, you know, collecting sensor data from all of these places around a system, and commingling them and processing them and activating things based on, you know, sensor data. And I needed a database that could, you know, move data around. Searched online for one. I came up with HarperDB, spun them up, integrated them into my product. Noticed that some of their documentation was a little out of date, so I rewrote their Postman collection and submitted it back to them. And then they invited me in for an interview, and that was it.
I love the getting started story. I've had conversations with too many people who have said, like, from the age of six, I knew I wanted to be in computers, and so I learned the thing. And it's just like how very qualified they always were. And I think back, in the late 90s, I was running the network center for an Army tank base. And at one point they said, and now you own the firewall. And so I was making changes to the firewall and turned on NAT over lunch. And if I broke it, I don't know who I would have called. And there was no one else who knew it. And I'm thinking I was wildly unqualified for that. Like, that's so much of my history is just like, why did you ask me to do that? But sure, why not? Let's see what'll happen. And it sounds like that's kind of your history too.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I taught myself HTML and a little bit of JavaScript, I was watching some reality TV show, and this woman popped up and she was like, hey, I was on my way to vacation in Mexico, picked up a book on HTML in the bookstore, got read it on the beach, came back, built a website, and now I'm the most downloaded woman on the internet, and I make like $1 million a day. And it was Danny from Danny's Hard Drive. And I was like, well, I mean, come on, I could learn that.
I would like $1 million.
HTML, AOL keyword. All right, tutorial number one. And then off to the races we go.
Nice. And a career is born. So working across the technology, and you've got your feet in advertising and marketing, you're, I presume, one of the driving forces behind the ongoing journey at HarperDB. And constantly trying to balance that product against the market fit, against what's going to sell and what's feasible, and, you know, just constantly evolving the company, the product, the processes, all of the stuff around it. That's got to be a pretty dynamic process. Can you talk a little bit about how you balance what customers are looking for, what you can provide, what's technologically feasible, you know, within the realm of the possible, and pushing that forward all the time?
Absolutely. I think we had a watershed moment where it all became easy. Mm-hmm. And in the fight for product market fit is always a balance, at least in an early stage, is resources versus revenue. And mm-hmm. what do I have to build to get the feature that you need so that you give me the money so that I can maybe hire more people and we can sort of spiral up. And I think we didn't know exactly what we wanted to be. We knew we wanted to be a distributed database, and that was great. And then people would ask us, what sort of auth do you support? I'm like, well, we have basic auth and token auth. And they're like, well, what about like Okta or, you know, Auth0? And I was like, well, okay, let's go back to the core team and ask them how you want to integrate this and like which version of it, because the protocol changed between 2 and 3. And now which one do we support? Do we support all of them? Are we going to support forever? And so a lot of time the answer was no, which is terrible for sales. And then we had a customer who asked, because our database had a native HTTP API. That is how you administer it. We call it the operations API. So we had an HTTP server in the database already. And a customer said, why can't I define my own endpoints so that they match the ones that I already have? So, you know, obviously we can't build their endpoints into, you know, a custom binary and do this for everybody. So mm-hmm. it was my task. I was tasked with the idea of figuring out how to add an application layer on top of the database where users mm-hmm. could define their own API endpoints, which begat defining your own auth method, which sort of turned into what our current architecture is, which is very, very component driven. our internal services, like replication between nodes of ArborDB, are components. Our operations API now is a component. And we have, you know, native interfaces like MQTT and WebSockets, and those are all components. But then you can build your own and drop them in. And all of a sudden it went, you know, the sales challenge went from, well, can you do this? And they're like, let me go talk to the team, and they're probably going to say no, to, yeah, absolutely, we can absolutely do that. And even more, we will do it for you. And then we will create a generic version of that, put that on our add-ons, you know, repo, and then anybody can drag it in and have Okta or have Azure AD, where your claims actually map to per table permissions. So we built all these translators, opened up the world, right? Now I'm not just talking about API endpoints. I'm talking about training machine learning based on data that I possess, activations and actuations and caching third-party APIs. So the product market fit came simply through having to tell enough customers no and realizing what was being left on the table.
Right.
And then the other promise that we keep making is that by moving data out to the edge, we'll lower latency, because then the queries are very, very fast. But moving data out to the edge, is it only works if you're also very close to where those API servers are for the customers. And when we got down to very real client engagements where we're trying to shave, you know, 10, 20, 30 milliseconds off of a transaction, they're like, well, what data center can you run in? Okay, what rack? Like, all right, you know what? I'm done. I'm just going to build an application layer, and then nobody will ever have to ask me, and I can control my own destiny. And the byproduct of that is obviously much lower latency, because there's no over-the-air call to, you know, from the API server to the database, better security, less translation and marshalling of data types. So it became a massive benefit to the product and the performance as well. But it was born out of necessity, because I couldn't keep saying no to people.
Fair enough. Okay. So in there, you mentioned customers trying to shave 20, 30 milliseconds off their response time. And that's one type of edge customer. I've come across a number of folks who are also edge customers, but they can't state it clearly, but I really get the feeling that they like the idea of cloud because they don't have to know or care about what they're running on, where it sits, how they're balancing, things like that. And with the edge, it's all about the locality. What are your thoughts on how we help customers manage their edge data and get that 20, 30 milliseconds shaved off and get the fast response times and the distributed nature of everything to capture all that distributed data without having to think about each piece of infrastructure that's going to go in and where it's going to locate and, you know, how they're going to manage it and such? How do we make, for lack of a better term, a cloud-like model? I hate saying that because it just sounds like, we'll just run AWS. But how do we get that cloud-like ease where you can just turn things on and don't have to think about which piece of hardware it's running on?
Yeah, it's a very real concern. In my previous job at the IoT platform, a low-code drag and drop, we blew half of our budget trying to figure out what a small, medium, and large node would look like so that we could solve the hardware problem. It has to be rugged. It has to be waterproof. It has to be able to run on solar power. It has to be able to sleep and wake up. It has to use non-IP Zigbee or you know, like a million things that it might need to do.
Right.
And the topography was endless. So yeah, we had a software platform that made it easy in one location, but the hardware was a nightmare. And when I came to HarperDB, we were running on ruggedized Raspberry Pis. You know, and part of the budget was swapping them out every 12 months.
Yeah.
And then a funny thing happened on the way to product market fit. All of the large, like, CSPs decided to redefine the word edge as like a zone that's slightly closer to you, a data center that's a little bit smaller, much closer to you, but I can still have 92 cores. So all of a sudden, edge computing became just... it's like a little closer to you. It's not right next to you. It's not running in your router.
Whole continuum of stuff now. It could be in your pocket, but it doesn't have
exactly.
to be.
Exactly. So I think the key for us was play where the money is. And we've beaten, now two successive companies have beaten my head against the true IoT, like edge device challenge. And I just don't have the appetite for it anymore when you know, there's lots of ways to deliver better latency by being closer. Mm-hmm. And there's other benefits besides that 10, 20 milliseconds. There's, you know, the resiliency associated with having a distributed footprint. In addition to the speed, there's the option, if you're doing machine learning, like training models, to use regional data, to not have to transfer everything over to some gigantic machine, to make regional classifications and recommendations. There's a lot of upside to still having the horsepower to do the cool things and not necessarily pushing out all the way to the edge. Now, that said, we can still run on a Raspberry Pi Sierra. I test that with every new release just because I like to be able to say we can. But is there real money at the far edge unless you're dealing with a truly embedded system that is, you know, hyper optimized, running on, you know, dedicated silicon, you know, custom silicon? Yeah, that's not where I'm going to play until, you know, that larger challenge gets solved.
So it's all kind of relative to where you sit in that continuum of edge. And it sounds like you can play in all the different places.
Yep.
But probably the most common answer becomes sort of regional data centers, edge-ish or pseudo edge.
Yep. I would love for it to be different because then that means I can obviously sell more licenses of my product. And I expect to get there because before the pandemic, nobody was coming to us saying the bare minimum I will accept is 50 milliseconds round trip. Nope. Mm-hmm. Nobody was asking for that on every request. Now that's like table stakes. If you can't figure it out in under 50 milliseconds, you're not part of the consideration set. And people will get used to that. And then people will start to feel like it's slow. And then somebody will figure out how to get even closer. And we'll be running HarperDB in every house. And then the data will just replicate out, you know, as part embedded within an application.
I love the Raspberry Pi idea. Pull it out of your pocket and run it on a battery just to demo it. That would be kind of fun.
I did that so many times. One of those big anchor batteries with the little screen and then the Raspberry Pi glued to the back of it and like the whole demo battery operated and two of them talking back and forth to each other. Absolutely.
I love the idea of walking into a customer and doing that. Pull it out of my backpack. Here's your demo. So back on data, the old data center view of data was capture everything because it was all relatively small data and you were in the data center and you had tons of disk. Why not? So just capture everything and keep it forever. And now, as data distributes, there's way too much of it and it's in weird places that are hard to move and blah, 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 whatever. But there's also most of it's low value. And we know this now, right? Like when your AI is doing inferencing and it knows exactly what it's finding, that unless you need some observability sort of tracking, it's not going to be useful for retraining. It's already trained perfectly fine. So that data is essentially worthless. But then some of it is like game-changing high value and identifying which is which on the fly so that you don't throw away this massively high value data, but you're not trying to write all of this low value data. I haven't found any sort of marketable solution yet for that. I don't know if we're ready for that yet or not, or if we're just not there yet. What are your customers typically thinking about when it comes to their distributed data? How are they handling it? Do they have some sort of answer to that? Are they even looking for it? Or do they know, you know, they're just inferencing and chucking it?
Well, one of the unique things about our HarperDB's replication technology specifically, and I'm not trying to be salesy, but it's one of the things that I really liked was not everything has to replicate everywhere. So for an instance that's sitting on a shop floor attached to a sensor that's measuring vibration or temperature for some piece of industrial equipment and a COM port, and I'm subscribed to that, I'm just collecting all those values. I'm putting that in a table that we usually call raw data. And raw data doesn't go anywhere. It can be processed, it can be looked at in real time, but it may be held on or retained for, we'll set a TTL on the table of, you know, 5 minutes. And I'm also monitoring other things. Let's say this TTL, this data that's coming in, I've got thresholds associated with it, and above or below certain numbers, it's a thing. It's a whole to do. So when it exceeds that, I will go grab the last 5 minutes and I will say, this is pre-event data. And I'll put that in the events table and I'll create this event for as long as it persists. and maybe I get post-event data for 5 minutes. I'll wrap that up, submit that, and replicate that somewhere to be processed and analyzed and dealt with. But I don't have to move everything around. And the other, where that ends up playing out is for classification and training. If I can train on a set of averages, like some sort of compressed nature, I can dramatically reduce the amount of data that I have. If I can train on summaries as well as I can train on the raw data, then I'm not going to hold on to that raw data for anything other than, you know, super emergency cases. And I'll start training on these summaries, on these averages of groups. And I can watch my accuracy fade over time, but I can decide where that level is acceptable. So yeah, I like to pre-process the data and then see how useful, you know, certain combinations of data are for my end purpose to see if I can reduce the amount on disk. Because you're right, the customers absolutely don't care. I mean, there's still a lot of them paying a lot of money to put every month's worth of data and to ship it off to some hyperscaler cold storage. And I know that it just sits there because I've got a closet with snowshoes from my racing career 15 years ago, and I can't seem to throw those things away. So I know that data is going to be there forever.
Yeah, that was by far the best answer I've ever heard. And I just want to sit with that for a while and absorb it. I feel like I'm done with my day now. Just that idea of writing it straight to a raw data file. And then if it doesn't go anyplace else, it never became useful. And if it does, then you put it someplace else as well and age out the raw data. That's elegantly simple, but addresses a whole lot of the needs. That's fantastic. So moving on, I've been in a lot of conversations about AI and about data and about the edge, like they're different topics. But the edge is where data is created, and AI is how that data is processed, and using the value of all of those things working together is why we pay for any of it, frankly. You know, our customers aren't doing this just for funsies. I don't think any customer ever said, you know what, I want to go train some machine learning. What are you going to do with it? I don't know. We'll just have fun. So are your customers handling data, AI, edge as separate topics, or are they typically coming to you with all of that sort of bundled together and looking for a comprehensive solution?
For the customers I've worked with where AI is a component of the larger system, and HarperDB has a role as a data fabric, the models are very specialized. I work with lots of sectors, and in the one where the most of the work is getting done, they are highly specialized models, and individual vendors, you know, are paid to bring in and have their own classification engines. They, in many situations, they have their own chipsets that are optimized for this. So I end up serving as a fabric for transport. A classification that may be made in one node needs to get to a different node because that's an action node, or it needs to verify and validate this, you know, this classification. Recommendations may go to a third server, and I provide, you know, the fabric between all of those nodes. But for that customer specifically, it's so specialized in terms of what each of these nodes do that everybody kind of manages their own pipeline, and the role that I play is pretty centralized. We have done work with other customers in, say, hospitality, where, you know, that TV channel that's always on when you turn on the TV, and being able to customize that based on your member ID, your travel history, your demographic information that I possess, and what goes up on that screen, what restaurants are presented to potentially make a reservation. That felt more comprehensive because all they wanted, right, they specify what the requirement is, which is a UI that gets displayed on the TV that you can move around and click, and that the things that are offered to click are tailored toward that person. So they have an end user requirement, and then the solutioning is on us and our partners. And so we think of it holistically, right? We think of it as, what are we going to sell them and what's it going to cost? But I think large enterprise has a sort of a different approach. And I think some of that is compartmentalization, right? I want you to do exactly what's good, but you don't necessarily need to see all of the parts of the whole. I want to protect my secret sauce, maybe isn't that I can train models better than you, because absolutely cannot do that. But the way I combine all of these models and this logic may be my secret sauce and may be the thing that separates us from the competition. I was having dinner with a friend probably 10 years ago, and he's a venture capitalist and an entrepreneur, and knew that I was in tech. And he asked me, what do you think the next big thing is? And I said, bespoke models. It's going to be bespoke models that have been trained on data sets around your industry, can ingest specific things from you, and then be delivered back to you, maintained, measured, redeployed, and retrained as necessary. And that happens as a service, because those people are going to be very good. Data scientists are very expensive, and they deserve all the money in the world. I'm an infrastructure guy, right? I can move the data around. I can right. run your classification engine, but I don't think I'm going to be as good as the guys who, you know, built their own silicon.
Which seems to be more and more people these days. There's a lot of silicon coming out. So that's actually an interesting point. Bespoke models, but as a service. So presumably coming off of reasonably commercially available models, reasonably standardized models, yep. and then just doing sort of transfer learning to refine it.
Exactly.
Do you think most people are going to need something that custom, or do you think those off-the-shelf models are going to become reasonably standardized? Do you expect that most customers are going to get more toward kind of commercial off-the-shelf models? I mean, at this point, Microsoft has reasonably pre-trained models, and Google has their own, and you know, each vendor has their own. You don't get to take them if you stop paying for their service. So it's kind of a stickiness for the service. You know, at what point do you expect customers to either break off and train their own so that they just own them, or just keep using standard models?
I think, well, Facebook released Llama, right? That's open source. Mm-hmm. So I think you will, I have to assume there's maybe some motive that's underneath there that may not be completely altruistic. But on the other hand, maybe it was. Maybe it's like a mea culpa. Sorry about Eastern civilization and Western civilization, but like, you know, here's a free language. Here's a free llama. Right. Everybody gets a free llama. I think that much like WordPress had templates, you know, because mm-hmm. at a certain point, a medical site looks like this and a retail site looks like this. And we had this template culture. I believe that those models will exist. There'll be a retrained llama, and it's retrained specifically for customer service in the hair and salon industry or whatever it might be. I think that those will eventually get there. I think right now people are building those and they're trying to launch their own version of a thing that's better than their competitor's thing. And eventually somebody will get fired. They'll rewrite their training mechanism and then they'll release that open source and say, add one llama, add your customer reservation data and your revenue data, and this will create a phone system that answers all your phone calls and makes reservations. That feels like how things tend to go together. Everybody tries to make a bunch of money up front, and then they mm-hmm. realize that they've built massive MLOps pipelines that are costing them like lots of money. And wait a second, that thing does 98% of it out of the box because, you know, mm-hmm. we've added in all this additional data. So I think bespoke models was maybe a naive view to say 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think that we are in the age of bespoke models now. But I think like all things, unless you're flying a remote drone armed with missiles, you probably will be able to make do with mm-hmm. a model that just handles the basics.
That makes sense. It's still so in flux right now. And it's really going to be interesting to see how this stuff settles out. And to your point, right, releasing an open source massive AI like that, that's expensive to build, but so many people will be able to use it now. How do they gain more than they gave up? You know, now we have the hyperscalers building their own AI chips mm-hmm. to run their own AI models, which presumably makes their AI models less portable. They're probably going to have to run on their hardware, which means in their cloud, which means as a service. And so that's like massive vendor lock-in. And then on the other hand, open source. Mm-hmm. Like these are completely, wildly, diametrically opposed business models. And I can't see both of them being long-term viable. One of them's going to win out and you're going to look at the other one and go, wow, that was dumb. And I can't guess which one right now.
I tend to look at it like I see that new Mercedes SUV with the portal axles and the six wheels. And I'm like, man, that's cool. Like there's a lot of technology in there that's neat. And there's no differential, you know, bump down there to get hit on a rock. And I'm like, man, everybody should have that. And I'm sure that in 20 years, like more cars than just the $500,000 Mercedes-Benz SUV may have portal axles, depending on how the apocalypse goes and whether how much clearance we need. Right. So I think the 80-20 rule probably applies in terms of what most people need. So the open source is probably fine. And while you will be outperformed by custom models that are maybe in your space, there's a cost to use those because those are owned and operated. So they're offering these models as a service as part of a hyperscaler. We see that in infrastructure, right? Distributed computing, where you know, everything seems fine. And that 0.000 cents per hour doesn't seem like a lot because that's a lot of zeros before the actual number. And then as you start to do more and you start to move more data in and pull more data out, you look over here and you're like, egress? Oh, there's lots of ways that these costs kind of come back on you. And and are you willing to pay for that performance? And certain competitors might in a space where it matters. People who are just trying to optimize the product listings in their Shopify store, they don't need that. So so they'll be fine with this and the world will go on. And that said, within a couple of years, much like the Mercedes, well, much like portal axles, I would expect all of those learnings and all those refinements about best practice in any given industry to have made it into one of these generic open source models. And now you're just a little bit behind the front runners who are building all the logic today.
This is so much fun. All right. Taking a hard left turn here. We'll get personal if you don't mind. I saw on your profile, you identify as a girl dad. I don't know what the appropriate response to that is. Congratulations or oh, or woo.
It started off as congratulations. And I was like, thank you so much. And now I feel like I'm just bear crawling around, just trying to stay low, keep out of the gunfire.
Yes. So do you mind telling us what you're doing to prepare your daughters for the world that we're building today, right? There are so many changes. Everything's decentralizing. We're moving toward AI, all the model changes. It's all in flux right now. And you're thinking about all of this and sitting in the middle of that web, which probably means you're thinking about how you're getting them ready for the world that we don't know yet. Once all of this stuff settles out, what does that look like in your house and in your head?
We tend to focus a lot on finding the answer yourself, problem solving. I suppose as a former, like, you know, manager of developers, I'm not hewing too far from that. You know, bring me one problem, three solutions you came up with, and the one you think we should go with. Don't just bring me problems, bring me solutions. Mm-hmm. And there's research involved in finding your three possible answers. And this is as simple as I spilled my milk and I'm kind of freaking out because it's all over me and it's all over the floor and it's all over like the cat and you're paralyzed. And I'm like, okay, you're in a crisis. Let's take a deep breath. It's just milk. Now, what's the order of operations? What ensures, you know, I think the day they learned to put the glass down on top of the paper towel and wipe the bottom of it so when they set it down, there wasn't like more milk on the table was like the greatest parenting victory I've ever had in my entire life. And as they've grown older, it just extends from that. It's let's overcome the initial reaction to any given crisis. And I think that's probably, I mean, being in database as a service world and dealing with clients and their data, there's always going to be some crisis and not being triggered by it is skill set number one.
I think a lot of consultants make their whole living based on that. Yeah.
Yeah. I just have no, I'm just dead inside and I don't react to a panic. I just don't do it anymore. And they're like, okay, let's take a deep breath. What's the solution? Okay. Well, if I walk over there, I'm going to get more milk on the floor because there's milk in my feet. Fair enough. So what's the first thing we should probably do? Well, I still need to walk over there and get that, but then I'm going to dry my footsteps on my way back, and then I'll start drying that. I'm like, perfect. What about the bowl you're holding? And what about the cat? Well, we're going to track down the cat later. Cat's probably going to, that's milk. That's a self-cleaning situation.
Yeah, cats, I feel like whatever.
Yeah, that has classified problem. And recommended a course of action, but that machine learning model is fine. It's going to be fine over there. And walking through the process of handling things that don't go the way you want. So that's resiliency in general as a child is super important. But I think when we go forward, we're going to have so many tools at our disposal that can do things. I can imagine a world where they're like, I'd like to create a favorites list on DHgate, which is the Chinese importer of dupes and replicas, and then sell them on a Shopify powered website called Grayson's Things. And an AI could probably build almost all of that. I can imagine, my kids are 9 and 5 right now. And I can imagine by the time they're in high school that they'll be able to absolutely launch an e-commerce site by just saying the words out loud. Like, Alexa, build me this. And it just happens. So In that world, I very much am like a get off my lawn, because I'm like, oh man, you don't have to write any code at all. When I was your age, I had to code uphill in the snow both ways. But what does that free them up to do? Think of all those ideas. Like when you first enter startup world, when I first left the agency, I had one customer, consulting client, and I had 5 ideas written on a whiteboard. And I officed with my consulting client, and he was a mentor and the CEO of this like little startup. And he's like, at some point, Jackson, you're going to have to choose one. And that's absolutely true. But I don't know if it's always going to be true. Because I don't know if you can't effectively outsource the construction of an idea to a really well-trained model. I don't know if you can't outsource customer service to a different, really well-trained model. Infrastructure and scaling, those tools already exist. Can AI look at that and execute, new Terraform scripts? And I think that it can. So I want to prepare them for crisis management first. And then I want to prepare them for, and we have done this. We like put them on ChatGPT and ask them to, write me a book report on this movie that we just watched, on this episode of Bluey, and, what the themes are. And you can identify maybe the themes and put those into ChatGPT and see if it comes out with anything that makes any sense. And watch them do it over and over and learn and turn them into little prompt engineers. Because I think that's kind of the coolest thing, the coolest new job that just popped up recently. Like, I'd love to. Are you kidding me? That'd be amazing.
See, I still think of that like typing, right? Like if you've been in the tech industry for long enough, that everyone used to put how many words per minute they could type on their resume, because that was a marketable skill. And now they're like, oh, prompt engineering. I think in 5 years, that's just going to be like,
skilled at internet search. I'm skilled at internet search.
Right. I can use Google.
Which, before Google, though, it meant using other things like Alta Vista. Right. And so now all of a sudden, I've got my skill set's woefully out of date. What's this Google thing? I always have to learn new technology.
Right. Yeah. I like that. Treating it, the crisis management as the foundation. That's yes. Yes, yeah. Fundamentally. And again, lots of consultancies are just based on that. Like, but what do you need to do first? Why don't you tell me? And then they write that down and give it back to you. Oh, here's what you need to do first. Oh, wow. Okay. And you're in crisis mode, so you don't see that.
Yeah. It's critical thinking and intellectual curiosity. And I reserve the right to change the strategy on the ground. But my belief is I don't know what tools they're going to have access to in 2 years, let alone 10. Mm-hmm. So it'd be foolish for me to be like, okay, you need to learn JavaScript. Nobody's going to type JavaScript. And I say that as the CTO of a literal database with a JavaScript application layer that's written in Node.js under the hood. So I get it. Somebody's going to be like, build me a distributed database that has like PubSub replication and no limit on the number of nodes, and let it be a document store. But maybe you can do joins, and that's it. And now, Harper DB.
And it's going to spit out a database for you.
Exactly.
And install it in all your remote locations. Yay. Good luck troubleshooting it. Oops.
Exactly.
Yeah. The troubleshooting will be fun. This was fantastic. It was so much fun. I'm so glad you made the time, and I really enjoyed it. I learned a bunch of things. And awesome. How can people find you online and keep up with the latest trouble you're causing?
HarperDB is at harperdb.io. And mm-hmm. we have a robust Slack community as well. If you'd like to try it out, take it for a spin. And we're always there to support new developers. We are a company of developers. We built this product because databases are hard. Distributed databases are even harder. And building modern applications just felt way too complex. So we try to build something that everybody can work with from POC to production. I think we've done a reasonable job, and I'd love to hear what you think.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you so much for the time, and have a great day.
Thank you so much.
That does it for this episode of Over the Edge. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and a review and tell a friend. Over the Edge is made possible through the generous sponsorship of our partners at Dell Technologies. Simplify your edge so you can generate more value. Learn more by visiting dell.com/edge.